The following talk was recorded at Libra Planet 2022, Living Liberation, an annual conference on current issues in ethics, social justice, and technology from the Free Software Foundation. Libra Planet is a live conference, and speakers often use slides and other visual tools to assist their presentation. You can see the videos of these talks at media.libraplanet.org or on the FSF PeerTube channel. Libra Planet speakers do not represent the mission of the Free Software Foundation. We host speakers talking about their uses of free software in different kinds of political and commercial work. The FSF supports their freedom, but does not take a position on any political issues other than those necessary to uphold the principles of free software. Like all the FSF's work on behalf of the freedom of all computer users, Libra Planet is made possible by thousands of individuals. To keep our work going, please consider becoming an associate member via my.fsf.org/join or making a donation at my.fsf.org/donate. You can stay informed by subscribing to our newsletter, The Free Software Supporter, at fsf.org/fss. For more information on Libra Planet, you can visit libraplanet.org/conference.
Now muted.
Hi, I'm Stephen, the room monitor for this talk titled Retracing Digital Freedom as Pattern Learning for Life, and will be presented by Greta Getz. Greta is an assistant professor in the English department at the Faculty of Philology, University of Belgrade. Greta, welcome, and please proceed.
Thanks so much, Stephen. So it's really great to be here. Thanks to all of the conference organizers. Super great talk by Hanra Rabic just now. So I'm now going to introduce my topic, which is, again, to retrace digital freedom. We're interested in how to model this in the classroom and give experience in digital freedom in the classroom. So I'm going to give you a brief outline of this talk, and I want to stress that I really hope that this talk will end in some really good conversations. So I'm going to try to keep this presentation short. These slide PDFs will be available to you for you to look at in your own time. And I'm actually not going to be going over every last detail on these slides, so that if you're interested in doing further reading yourself, you're going to have some resources to look at in the slide PDFs afterwards. So my goal here is to give you a bird's eye view into some of the things that I think about as a teacher who's really concerned about teaching digital freedom in the classroom. So to jump right in, I want to think about how it is that digital freedom maps onto life in general, and then how it maps on more specifically to what are known as wicked problems, specifically the kinds of wicked problems that we see more of today. So what do we mean by wicked problems? We mean really hard to solve problems that have a social cultural component. So this means that these are the problems that we encounter in our lives, which is why hopefully in our education system, we learn how to cope with these problems. And today, many of these types of wicked problems are caused by technology that spills over into the social cultural. And many different kinds of thinkers from different disciplines have defined these problems. I'm going to give you one example from the French philosopher Bernard Stiegler, who described what he calls 24/7 capitalism, which is constantly mining data from us, aggregating it, analyzing it at a speed that's 4 million times faster than our nervous systems. And he says that these processes overtake and short circuit our ability to make our own decisions and even our ability to have dreams of what is possible. So this is one definition of the kinds of wicked problems that we are seeing today. And to expand upon this, drawing on a different philosopher, we can say that today these data banks are aggregating all of this data on us, data about the traces that we leave behind us as we make our passage through time. So we have always left traces, but today these traces are ever more digital. These digital traces are aggregated in these data banks, where there is an attempt to control collective memory. So throughout history, there's been an attempt to monopolize the meaning of the traces that we leave behind us as human beings on the part of the powerful and on the part of the clerisy, according to Paul Ricoeur. So another problem of this is not only that it's this monopoly over what our digital traces mean, but another problem is that these data banks are not accountable to people in the flesh, meaning the data bank doesn't care about the context in which you left your digital trace, which meant something to you in your own terms, but that digital trace is being taken out of context and being used by the powerful to certain ends. So these are examples of some of the wicked problems that we find ourselves in. And this sounds like a rather depressing beginning to this talk, but what we want to think about in teaching about digital freedom is being able to map out what these problems are so that we can choose our own adventure in our own pursuit of digital freedom. So indeed, what I want to point out is that we do always need to strive to get a mental map of where we find ourselves and the kinds of problems we're surrounded by, because this is an important way of knowing. And I would like to suggest that if we think about life as being defined as a process of ongoing learning, like what does it mean to be alive? It means that we're always learning new ways to better experience our lives and express ourselves. Well, then in this model of learning, wicked problems are not as intimidating as they might seem, because they are just one part of life that belongs to a larger system of knowledge that we are building and enabling ourselves through this knowledge to, again, make better decisions. So what I want to suggest is that we can even visualize these systems, these wicked problems, and how they connect to each other through visualizations like the one you see in the background to this slide. This is a visualization that was created by the Mexican architect Antonio Toca Fernandez when he thought, well, what would the Argentinian writer Jean-Louis Borges's infinite library look like? Imagine, what would an infinite library look like? How could you visualize that? So he created this diagram with these interconnected rooms, and he created a mental model that could conceptually contain infinite knowledge. So think about that, which we can now see in our brains, versus big data that is siphoning off all of the data from us. So suddenly we, in our minds, can put big data in a place within our minds. We can contain it within our own thinking. Historically, human beings have sought to create models that interrelate all of the knowledge that is known in such a way that they could internalize it in their minds. Some examples of this are the method of the loci, or the ancient Greek education system, which insisted that, it was only available to men, but that men have physical education, character building, civic values, and the sciences. So it was very broad ranging. We can see examples of people attempting to categorize all that is known about the world, or to map out all human knowledge into trees of knowledge, where each branch is a separate discipline with sub-branches and so forth. So what we're trying to do in the background to this talk on pursuing digital freedom is to get a mental map of knowledge so that we can put big data in a place within our own minds. And if we are concerned with a model of life where we say, okay, we're ready to continue to learn how to learn about the world in order to improve the quality of our lives, we can then make use of these mental models. So if we need a model of how it is that we can conceptualize ongoing learning, like that sounds really abstract, we can use the example of free software. Free software, with its four freedoms, puts emphasis on studying, so emphasis on learning, emphasis on sharing this learning, on sharing this knowledge, and then emphasis on improving this knowledge. So it goes on in ongoing iterations. So free software then is a model of ongoing learning, and it's also an example of a tool that can be used to help us aggregate our own knowledge. So for example, some of us here use Emacs, and Emacs is a really great repository for all of our knowledge and helps us better organize it and navigate through it. So that's an example of a knowledge system that has a precedent. If we look at what Doug Engelbart did, he said, okay, well, how can we use the digital tool to help augment our own knowledge? So not to augment the knowledge of the data banks, but to augment our own knowledge. Free software as an example of ongoing learning, as an example of a kind of work that values creativity, because again, we're creating something if we're improving the existing software, and through its emphasis on sharing knowledge, is an example of a contributory economy. It is an example of work that values values. So it values the value of creating, it values the value of sharing, and it is further an example of what Bernard Stiegler calls surprising work, work that is surprehension, above our comprehension, above our reason. And you might think that sounds strange. Well, if we go back to the kinds of problems that we can diagnose today, and we say, indeed, you know, we things really aren't that great right now with all of this digital tracking, spyware that was imposed. If we're going to talk about the context of learning, people had to use Zoom in some classroom situations, and security expert Bruce Schneier describe that as malware. So people were actually forced to use malware. So that's like a bad context in which we're finding ourselves. But if we, you know, can go beyond our reason and our analysis of that and dare to create something, so to bring something new into being, just like people in the free software community are continuing to extend the range of tools that are available, the creation of this new software is bringing us to a place and bringing us to new ideas that we couldn't see at the beginning when we were just simply analyzing the wicked problem. So we're trying to go beyond comprehension and bring something new into being. So again, we're valuing the value of creativity. We're seeing free software as an example of a learning model that we can learn from and that we can practice ourselves. So again, digital freedom is this model, but I'm going to define it now more specifically as an example of pattern design learning. So what do we mean by pattern design? The term comes from architect and design theorist Christopher Alexander, and he was interested in a human-centered form of design that is looking to create local solutions to the needs of the actual specific people in these local contexts. And then he would design for multiple local contexts on this micro level. And once he had a collection of these micro plans, he would have a macro level of design where he could reconfigure these designs, extend them, further customize them, and so forth. So remember that we began this talk with this idea of these mental models. So now we're not just thinking of mental models, but we're thinking of ways in which to configure these mental models. And it should come as no surprise to us that Christopher Alexander's work has many broad applications, ranging from programming, like in Gabriel's work or Lee's work, or also in pedagogy. So I'm now going to focus on the work of Peter Goodyear and his colleagues. And they were really impressed by this idea of pattern design and applied it to learning. So what we're thinking about in teaching digital freedom is how it is that we're going to configure our learning environments such that there's emphasis on what should be cared for and what is worth doing. So this is a very different kind of learning than teaching to the test. And we know that teaching to the test was industrialization's way of making human beings into replaceable cogs. But that is really not a very sustainable learning model today at this time of immense change. And so what we are thinking about now is how to design learning environments that allow us to, again, emphasize what should be cared for and emphasize what is possible. Maybe what we're teaching for doesn't yet exist, but we're trying to promote creativity, promote knowledge sharing, and so forth. And in order to design for possibility, we're thinking about how we're configuring the digital tools within this context. So it's not just a question of using a prefabricated digital tool. It's a question of thinking very deeply about what the tool does or what it could do and how it could be applied to people, activities, tasks, and of course, outcomes. Again, what should be cared for. So designing for possibility in thinking about positioning things in relationship to one another should also take into consideration the problem of affordances. In my teaching, I really try to look for individual talents among my students, and they really do differ. So if you are trying to create a knowledge environment or knowledge building environment that caters to all kinds of students, you want to design affordances within this design where explanations can be provided for learners that need them. So this can be achieved through modeling, through giving an example of how to do something, but it can also be achieved by learners helping other learners. So we're also thinking about designing for digital freedom in such a way that maximizes the skill sets of those who are maybe more competent at something and getting them to experience autonomy, responsibility, and leadership roles by helping their fellow learners. And we're also thinking too about designing our learning environments in such a way that learners can guide themselves, because tomorrow, of course, students are no longer students and exist beyond the educational institutions. So we're trying to give practice and experience in autonomous movement through these learning experiences. So how are we going to do that? We're going to give our students experience in interdisciplinary skills. So I'm not saying that we're going to abandon the disciplines that we're trying to teach, but I am saying that we're going to add on to that some interdisciplinary experience. And notice the word experience. So it's not, again, teaching from a textbook and asking for memorization, but it's building projects and problem-based learning design into the learning experience. And in addition to that, we were saying that we want to think very deeply about how the digital tool is being used in the classroom. And so instead of just, again, using a digital tool passively, we are thinking about the design principles behind the software tools. So this means that when we're using digital tools in class, we're actually saying something about the tool and starting conversations about the choice of the tool. So I'm going to illustrate what I mean by that. Let's say, for instance, that you are teaching a course on graphic design, and maybe your institution does not allow you to use non-proprietary software. They force you to use proprietary software. So how could you present to your department an argument as to why you really shouldn't introduce a component on Inkscape, for example? You could say, well, what if the proprietary software that we're using in class does not exist 10 years from now? We need to give students a skill set of being able to compare different software programs that accomplish certain tasks in order for them to see the design principles behind the software tools, because this makes them more resilient and it also allows them to better understand how to use the tool to begin with, which is also very important. So what we see on this slide, and again, I'm not going to read through everything on all the slides, are three examples of sample course components from what we call networked learning. So we can combine two different classes from two different disciplines that would collaborate together on a project. And so I'm going to read this first example. We could take a course on culture and a course in graphic design and have the students collaborate on a site about digital freedom. So the students are doing the research, the students are doing the building, what the teachers are doing are just designing this task, and of course there to provide support. There are many different ways in which we could delegate this work. So we have these two classes, they're collaborating. We could say, so how are we going to break down the project itself? Who's going to do what? So one example would be to have both classes ideate, have both classes think, how would I design a site about digital freedom? And then have them come together and discuss how their respective knowledge domains informed the choices that they made as to how they decided to design this website on digital freedom. So this would allow, for example, the graphic design students to be exposed to some of the concerns that students in a course on culture might have about the presentation of content. So each person within their knowledge domain takes their knowledge for granted and thinks that it makes the most sense. But in today's very complex world, again, one with wicked problems where the technology is spilling over into the social cultural, we need to have more of an ear for each other. So graphic students should be aware of some of the impediments that students learning about culture have when they are interacting with technology. And you can read more about this kind of concern in terms of decolonizing user experience design. So actually, in one of the components that I taught on in this very example, my students themselves started this conversation on decolonizing user experience design. So they said, oh, well, a lot of this digital technology doesn't give us an opportunity to co-create with this knowledge. We feel like we're just little serfs who have to use this software passively. We don't feel like there's enough listening to people like us with our concerns. So that was a really neat moment. And those are the kinds of things that can happen if we set up a project-based learning component within our classes. So other learning components are, there are just so many, include, for example, having students write a game or book narrative on the obstacles to adopting free software. And they could dramatize this using the resource that I've listed here. If we are dealing with students who've never even thought about digital freedom before, then we make affordances for them. And maybe we just begin by having them experience digital gardening and make their own place on the internet that's designed exactly as they want it to be designed, and to give them experience in having full control over their digital, how they appear via digital media. So a point that I want to return to now is this question of how it is that we are teaching students that there are choices in the design of knowledge and how knowledge is shared and discovered. We're not trying to teach students to be passive consumers of digital technology, but to really think about there being choices. So how do we want to discover knowledge? We know today that many people lament at how the larger browsers or search engines don't work the way we want them to. So then how can we explore alternatives? So we could introduce components that introduce other protocols or other ways of using knowledge management systems than those that we are pre-served with. So for example, many people use prefabricated teaching interfaces like Google Classroom, but as opposed to that, we could create our own knowledge management system for our classes. So that's something that I have done. I made a wiki for my class that uses a really simple template that I built on top of a pre-existing content management system text pattern. And then by building this wiki for my class, my students become writers on the internet, and they categorize their information, their knowledge in different ways, interlink with each other, annotate their notes and share their annotated notes with each other. So we're again thinking about how it is that we are configuring the digital tool in our classrooms, and maybe even thinking about less conventional ways of using the digital tool in the classroom. So while Git is often used or most commonly used for version control and programming, we could use Git in a classroom for version control of a large shared document that students collaborate on. So the learning components then are both task-based, but they are also tool-based and really considering how it is that we're using the digital tool in the classroom. More learning components, I could go on forever, but we are nearing the end, don't worry. More learning components that are less structural. So if some teachers are a little bit overwhelmed on introducing the topic of digital freedom into the classroom, they could just do so by periodically asking questions or presenting ethical dilemmas. So I'm not going to go over these two top points, but I'll talk to you very briefly about technical dilemmas. Thus far in computer science, students have been able to learn the basics using free software. And this is a really beautiful example of what we in networked learning call equality, which is the opportunity to co-create knowledge. This opportunity exists because the knowledge is shared because it's free software. But what's going to happen if there is an AI revolution? We know that AI has been developed using proprietary technologies. So what are we going to do in the classroom if we don't have access to those technologies? So I'm suggesting that we start to think about this now. Are we going to introduce more units on computational thinking? Are we going to introduce more units on reverse engineering? So we want to really be thinking about how we're structuring our learning in response to the changing world. So just as students are experiencing ongoing learning, so are we as teachers. The last point from this slide that I want to talk about is actually an extension of this previous one. We shouldn't be afraid in the classroom to include pain points that exist in the world. So we're saying, oh, well, we might be facing an AI revolution that could be seen as overwhelming, like, again, these wicked problems. But we are introducing these pain points in the classroom in a controlled environment, in a positive environment where we're all learning how to learn together and solve problems. And so another pain point we could introduce into the classroom is, why is it that people are so resistant to using free software if the tools exist? And the one point I'm going to make before we move on here is the personal and social factor that is at play in the decision-making behind the habits that we fall into in terms of our choices of digital technology. So how we choose digital technology, or what digital technology we're choosing to use, is based on our personal decisions. So how can we model in the classroom more of free examples of software use? So obviously the teacher can choose to use free software in the classroom. In addition to that, if a teacher notices that one of their students is using free software, they can use 10 minutes at the end of a class period and have that student share with the class how it is that they are integrating the use of free software into their workflow and say a few words about its productivity. So never then forgetting that even if we're teaching a technical subject, there are these social elements that are very interconnected with technology that we could talk about periodically. So we're not going to say, oh, you know, if technology is a wicked problem and that involves social cultural elements. We're going to throw out the technical. Obviously, that's not what we're saying, but we are saying that there needs to be these interdisciplinary components that are added on to the class. So speaking of the personal role in creating habits of what it is that we're doing and how it is that we're doing it, understanding the important place that the individual has. So actually, let me go back for a minute and explain that in terms of personal learning networks. We can learn a lot by basing our behaviors on, or basing our learning on the learning of those around us. So what we really want to think about in pattern design learning is how to create an environment in our classrooms where students experience themselves as supporting actors and as members who are able to reconceptualize the environment. So by contrast, in the traditional classroom, students were passive observers, but now we're saying, no, we don't want that to be the experience in the class, but rather students to experience themselves as co-participators in a live environment that changes according to their very actions during the duration of a course. So I've seen this, for example, in the project learning components that I introduce, where what students know and think is possible before the project is extremely different from what they know and think is possible after the project. So we see transformation in the learning. And so this is very important to structure our learning in such a way as to give students an experience of the potential of how much they can change by seeing themselves as co-participants. And in addition to this, we want to give experience too in this new idea that you can't expect learning to give you like a glossary that you memorize and then you're finished and then you know your knowledge domain and you never have to learn again in life. Rather, we want to give experience in the classroom of how sometimes vocabulary will be missing, whether this be because the person they're communicating with doesn't have the vocabulary. And if that person doesn't have the vocabulary, your vocabulary won't help you communicate with them. Similarly with mental models, if you've mastered your mental model of, say, for instance, programming, and if somebody else doesn't have that mental model, it will be very hard to communicate. So even if you have studied programming, you still need to have some practice in communicating with people who might not share the mental model, particularly because we are living in a time of change. And because there is so much restructuring, there is a need for all of us together to be sharing our knowledge to increase the potential of positive possibility for us all. So if all these things that I've been saying seem a little bit overwhelming, can I give you like a simple illustration of how we can give students experiences in thinking through these kinds of things we've been talking about? So I found a really great example of learning that was produced by the Austin Center for Design. They had some students create these reflective zines that allowed the students an opportunity to express their own thoughts on the relation of tech, design, power, and social responsibility. So again, if big data is tracking us, we are now reconfiguring our own understanding of what that all means. So in some ways then we are taking back control of our digital trace because we're taking back the power over what it means. And then we're sharing this knowledge with each other. So this is the final slide for the main body of this presentation. I wanted to end with an example of successful information and communication technology design. I mentioned very briefly earlier how many people used Zoom during the pandemic. I mean, I'm still teaching online. And then they thought that that was a successful use of technology in teaching. But what we know from networked learning is that the entire design of teaching needs to change if we are relying more on technology. So again, we're thinking of the configuration between the people, the tools, the activities, the kinds of activities that we're designing, and again, the desired outcomes of putting emphasis on that which matters. So Bernard Stiegler taught a MOOC, and then he brought into this class people from different knowledge domains, and they would read the same texts, but again, because they come from different knowledge domains, their interpretation of these texts were different. And so he created an annotation language that they all shared. They would upload their notes using the shared annotation language, and then an algorithm would go through these notes and analyze the similarities and the differences. And these were used as discussion points where students would then continue the discussion and debate. So what we see here is an example of using the technology to exteriorize our own knowledge. So say I'm reading, I'm interpreting in my own brain, but then I'm sharing my interpretation with somebody else. And then if an entire class does this, we are then extending our knowledge and our understanding of what the text means. And we are also participating in a contributory social circuit. So this emphasis on sharing knowledge then is something that we can continue to explore in the classroom. And again, thinking of innovative ways to use digital tools to do so. And sharing may sound to you like a word you remember from earlier in this presentation. And indeed, we know that is a central characteristic of free software. So to conclude, how is free software pattern learning for life? Let's retrace this talk, going back over it in attempt to rediscover what it was that I was saying. We said that knowledge is a way to take care of things such as wicked problems. And we've said that in order to do this, we need to think about how it is that we're configuring our learning environment in order to leave co-creative digital traces. How are we using the tools in order to make a space for everyone to feel welcome to leave their contribution and to create something? Creativity and sharing are characteristics of free software. As such, it is a good pattern for life. It encourages us to learn how to learn, to learn how to share our knowledge and improve our knowledge. It values these values. And ultimately, it is an example of surpréhension, something that goes beyond our reason, by bringing a creative work that wasn't there before into existence. And thanks to the existence of this work, we have new ideas. And I'd like to point out that if it weren't for free software, all of these ideas that I've been saying wouldn't be possible to express, because I'm basing this entire talk on the model of free software and also on the free software tools that I used to put this talk together. So on that note, thank you very much to all of the free software developers, maintainers, contributors, community, and also the LibrePlanet organizers. Thank you very much for listening to this talk. This is the end of my part of the of this meeting between us, but I hope now that you have some questions, or maybe you have some ideas to share, or anything that you want me to go over again, if there are any questions or of this sort. So thank you very much for listening, and thank you for coming.
Well done, Greta.
Thanks very much. I hope I haven't gone over time.
No, we still have, I believe, about 7 or 8 minutes.
Oops.
No, that's fine. We do have a couple questions. The first one is, can you talk a little more about the software imprinting dilemma? And is this related to technological drift?
Okay, so the phrase software imprinting dilemma comes from Jeff Atwood, and he was actually talking about, oh dear, there's a phrase, is it bird imprinting, baby imprinting? It's what animals do, how they're the patterns of their learning. But he was saying that in software use, what happens to people is that they learn how to use one kind of software, and then they're no longer open to other software because they took all the time to learn this one program. And even if another program or other software does the job better, they're resistant to exploring that because it does take time in order to relearn things as well. So people get stuck in usage patterns. That would be fine if we were all using Emacs. Sorry, I had to make that. But, you know, if we're stuck using bad software, then we can see that this can be really harmful. Technological drift. I don't know if I should follow up on that, or should I move to a new question? As a student, yeah. Can I ask? Yeah. Could I avoid Zoom during remote classes? You know what? I was looking at what Richard Stallman was recommending about this, because I, for some short period of time, was forced as a member of staff to use Zoom last year. And RMS recommended that we ask our institutions to kindly provide an alternative. I did that. It didn't work in my case. But actually, there was a talk yesterday by a Brazilian who was saying, you know, students really should go to their administration and ask to make changes. I mean, it really depends on what kind of institution you are, you belong to. But I know that where I teach, the institution is quite responsive to students. So there are places, there are countries, and there are contexts where that might be something worth thinking about. Yeah, a big blue button is an alternative to Zoom, but then the administrators would have to learn how to use that. And so then we go back to the software imprinting dilemma. Are there any other questions? I don't think so, as far as I've seen.
No, it looks like just some advice about alternative or a way to approach Zoom with a phone. And then getting some friends to help.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's a nice hack.
And suggest, of course, big blue button. And then this, someone's would like to interest young people. I'm not trying to get the question out of that.
Oh, annotation language. Yeah, okay, so Stiegler what made his own annotation language, and you can see a link to Lewin University in the resources of these slides. So I'll just skip through this. Oh, and by the way, were the slides shared with the?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, yeah,
shared them. Yep.
So I'll just skip through that slide. So that was Stiegler's version of this, but with Ted Nelson, I mean, there are so many different people working on this problem. Strasser's one, who was also thinking about, so luckily that's on the same slide, trying to figure out like ways of building new software that could do this in a more achievable way than the Xanadu project, for example. So different people trying out different things. I think I would definitely recommend reading Strasser, because he went in the, like, he tried to get VC funding and really went that, like, not free software route, but the opposite to that, and has some very interesting experiences of that journey and of that path to better annotate and exchange knowledge. Okay. Seems like there are no more questions, but thanks very much for those questions. I'm really glad there were at least a few.
Yep, we still have a little time left, a couple minutes, if there's anything else. But yes, thanks very much for a very nice presentation, and you touched on some broad topics and also got into the specifics, and I appreciated that as being a newcomer to thinking about this from a student teacher perspective.
Thanks very much for that. And it's great that there are some comments here about how to use games in education. And that's something that is underexplored. I mean, there are, it is becoming more common in teaching to use role-playing, for example, as a way to learn history, but I really think, like, how great it would be if we could get some collaboration from the side of programming with professors and have, like, customized games that are built. Because at the moment, it's like people sharing a same platform, like Barnard College has their way of involving games in the classroom. And so they've designed their own, but then you have to use what they designed. But what if we had, like, lots of independent programmers who could offer their services to teachers to design, like, miniature components that would be really crafted to local situations? So that's something that I think isn't explored fully enough. And that's another thing I really wanted to learn more about at this conference, is how it is that we can join up with local programmers. Because sometimes, you know, I'd really like to delegate my work, because I'm learning how to program. I learned how to program in order to, like, create the digital tool for my class that I'm using. And I lost sleep over that. And now, you know, what if I could support programmers in my community and then have them, you know, help create these little tools? And they're not super huge, especially if you're thinking it in terms of one class. I'm not Barnard College. I'm not creating my whole program. So, so lots of space for collaboration in this respect, I think.
So true. Okay, well, I believe our time's up, and hopefully there'll be some more conversation in the chat as we leave here. But thanks again, and congratulations on an excellent talk.
Thanks very much. Thanks for being such a gracious and fun presenter of this room.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.